terms of taking, and think about how that resistance needs to be manifested. So that there is one level in terms of demonstrations, in terms of all of these things that are going to be taking place on the ground, and they have been happening for years and decades in some senses, in terms of what's been going on. Obviously, with the whole 2011 and where it started, that was, there was an intensity that was created after that period of time that it was going on for. But I think obviously all of these things will continue, but I think another angle in terms of whether looking at resistance in a different kind of form might be an option that needs to be looked at. So I think that I would say that people need to look at those options, and when those options are on the table, the government will start to think, okay, is it really going to be worth my while to take on a resistance that is going to be much more assertive and aggressive in what they do?
Okay, and on that note, appreciate you being with us, both of you, actually. Author and former U.S. diplomat Michael Springman, out of Washington, D.C. Always a pleasure, Michael. And Islamic Human Rights Commission, Reza Kazem, out of London. Thank you so much. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program.
Ramadan is here, Allah's mercy is near. Time to give, time to share, time to show we care. Cause Ramadan is here, whoa, Ramadan is here.
Today's lesson, a favorite fast observer. The fast observer should consider himself as hereafter's traveler, should remain in the state of humility, fear, self-degradation, and like a servant fearing his master. He should remain afraid of Allah. His heart should remain pure from defects and contamination. And his inner self should be free from everything accept Allah. He must sacrifice his entire friendship and intentions for him, and must purify his heart from all other friendships except Allah's. He must surrender his eyes and soul to Allah, must commit his soul for his remembrance, must utilize his body in Allah's path, and must keep it distant, apart, especially the tongue, from all sorts of sins and indecencies. Whoever has observed these limitations had indeed discharged his obligations of fasting properly, and whoever has shown negligence to discharge these obligations has wasted his fast and would not have benefited from its reward. We know that Islam expects a lot from us. Sometimes it's overwhelming, right? The thing is, fine, you can't get to the best of the best level, but try for something better than you currently are achieving. Nevertheless, in the holy month of Ramadan, even if you cannot reap the entire and full benefits of this holy month, try to do your level best, fast in the way of Allah, fast for the sake of Allah, and make sure your heart is connected to Allah.
رمضان المستبين جاء بالنور المبين رمضان 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 القانتين.
Welcome back, dear listeners. Today we are discussing the topic of favorite fast observer. We know that there are different types of people who fast. Some just stay hungry, others fast the way fast should be kept. Now, a fast observer who considers himself as a hereafter's traveler, a traveler who is nearing his final destination, obviously will not be interested in worldly allurements and will not pay attention towards anything except collection of provisions for his eternal journey. Or, for example, a best and a fast observer who is in a state of humility and heartbrokenness would not be interested in anything except attaching himself to Allah, the glorious, the exalted, and would be pleased with his remembrance. And the fast observer who has surrendered his body and soul absolutely to Allah, the glorious, the exalted, wouldn't care for anything except Allah. Inevitably, his soul and body, self and conscience, and his entire existence would be filled with Allah's remembrance, Allah's love, Allah's worship, and Allah's servitude is going to be filled in this person. And the fasting of someone like him is the fasting of the favorites. Remember, there's a great ability in fasting and great ability of fasters. Some people just stay hungry and thirsty. Others do a little bit more. And then there are those select few who keep the fast the way it should be kept. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
You know that I will be better, that I will be stronger.
prominent international rights group has accused Israel of pursuing policies of apartheid and persecution against the Palestinian people. Human Rights Watch says the policies amount to crimes against humanity. In a 213-page report, the HRW points to Israeli restrictions on Palestinians' movements and land grabs for the construction of settlements in the territories occupied in 1967, calling them examples of policies that are crimes of apartheid. The rights group said Israeli authorities have pursued intent to maintain domination over Palestinians by exercising control over land and demographics for the benefit of Israelis across the occupied territories. HRW called on the International Criminal Court to investigate and prosecute individuals credibly implicated in the apartheid and persecution. This says just a few weeks back, the court said it would investigate war crimes by the Israeli military in the occupied West Bank and Gaza Strip. This brings to the spotlight the fact that the regime has continued with its violation of Palestinians' rights for decades amid silence of the West in dealing with such crimes.
Well, I think it's very welcome. It really doesn't, to those of us who have any familiarity with the reality on the ground there, there are no real revelations, nothing new. And one of the thoughts that comes to mind is what's taken them so long to acknowledge these realities. But nevertheless, it's welcome that they are acknowledging them now, I think. And the report in particular, I haven't had a chance to read every word of it, but I've given through it and read the summary and so on. One of the things it does that I think the previous statements in this area have not done is to do a pretty rigorous analysis of what international law actually says and to make the case that the realities in Palestine actually match the international legal definitions of these crimes against humanity, specifically the crime of apartheid and something that was new to me as a legal concept, the crime of persecution.
The report by the Human Rights Watch comes as even Israeli advocacy groups have accused Israel of being an apartheid regime. Just a few months back, advocacy group B'Tselem said that Israel is an apartheid regime that systematically oppresses the Palestinians via military occupation and racist laws. B'Tselem said the regime in Tel Aviv uses laws, practices, and organized violence to cement the supremacy of one group over another. It added the Israeli apartheid, which promotes the supremacy of Jews over Palestinians, was not born in one day or of a single speech. The group added this is a process that has gradually grown more institutionalized and explicit, with mechanisms introduced over time in law and practice to promote Jewish supremacy.
You know, it's true that it has gradually been more institutionalized and consolidated. On the other hand, I have to say, I first went to the occupied territories, specifically, to both the West Bank and to Gaza in 2002, and I don't claim any special enlightenment, but all this was pretty obvious to me back in 2002. So, it takes a long time for these groups to face up to the reality, which was pretty clear to me way back then.
Israel occupied the West Bank and East Jerusalem al-Quds during the Six-Day War in 1967. It later annexed East Jerusalem al-Quds in a move not recognized by the international community. Palestinians won the West Bank as part of a future independent Palestinian state with East Jerusalem al-Quds as its capital. But Israel's aggressive settlement expansion and annexation plans have dealt a serious blow to any prospects of peace. Meanwhile, the Gaza Strip has been under an inhumane Israeli land, air, and sea blockade since 2007 and witnessed three wars since 2008.
Of course, they're outrageous and shocking, and no other country in the world would be able to go on with impunity and continue to be acknowledged as a great democracy and to get billions of dollars in U.S. aid every year and so on and so on. It's, frankly, I think it's because of the power of the Zionist forces and the political power, cultural power of Zionist forces in the United States that makes this all possible.
That said, what better characterizes Israel's apartheid practices are Tel Aviv's violations, including unlawful killings, forced displacement, abusive detention, the siege of the Gaza Strip, and other unjustified restrictions on movement and the expansion of settlements. However, what can only bring these really apartheid policies to an end is a united front by the international community against such practices that are only aimed at dislodging the Palestinians from their land, namely Palestine.
Black and ethnic minority students have for long been victims of institutional racism in the universities of Britain. However, it seems British universities have not done enough to combat the racism, as their students believe that their complaints were mishandled. According to a Guardian report, universities fail to handle tens of thousands of complaints about racist incidents annually. A research from the Equalities and Human Rights Commission was published in 2009, revealed some interesting yet embarrassing facts about racism at UK universities. The research suggested that one in four of the students participating in the survey had experienced racial harassment since their course started. Also, 1 in 20 students said that they left their course because of it. Moreover, two-thirds of students who experienced racial harassment avoided reporting it to their university. They were mainly concerned about being labeled as a troublemaker or feared that the complaint could affect their course or believed the university would not take it seriously. Meanwhile, a report from the university's UK organization says that British universities are continuing to perpetuate institutional racism. The report also highlights a range of issues, including a lack of diversity among senior leaders, minority ethnic student attainment gap, and ethnicity pay gaps among staff. Only about 110 out of the over 18,000 UK university professors are black. In addition, only 3.2% of academic managers, directors, and senior officials are from ethnic minorities, and they are paid 16% less than UK-domiciled white officials and managers. Furthermore, black undergraduates have higher dropout rates. Professor David Richardson, the University of East Anglia's vice chancellor, who leads the university's UK's advisory group on racial harassment, says that British universities are institutionally racist. He acknowledged that racial harassment in universities is underreported, and stress the importance of providing support for the ethnic minority students.
Well, I think that people forget that the UK is still really a post-colonial nation. It's a post-imperialist nation in many ways, although that's arguable. And that carries with it its natural issues and problems. For instance, migrant issues, which are a fear factor and also a hatred. And you've seen an exponential rise in racism and racist political movements.
46-year-old African-American George Floyd died on May 25 in the northern U.S. city of Minneapolis after a white police officer pressed his knee on his neck for nearly 9 minutes. He continually gasped, "Please, can't breathe," until his heart stopped. This incident triggered massive outrage against police brutality and racial prejudice. Demonstrators across the world have staged rallies in solidarity. Rallies known as the Black Lives Matter protests swept the UK last year as well. Protesters in Britain toppled or removed statues of slave traders, including that of Edward Colston in Bristol. They also vandalized a memorial to Winston Churchill in central London with the words, "Was a racist." There has since been a public reckoning with Britain's slavery and colonial past. The protests forced British authorities to take down or to remove scores of tributes to slave traders, colonialists, and racists across the UK.
Well, let me give one example, and it's linked to this university report that you've covered. Basically, let's take Oxford and Cambridge as institutions which are well known around the world, global institutions known for their so-called excellence in education. Well, they've been failing the black communities in particular almost systemically, and this institutional systemic structural racism is where the real danger lies.
Following the Black Lives Matter protest, a research shows the number of black people who said they have faced racial discrimination last year increased from 74% in 2019 to 81%. While the UK's past is not hidden from anyone, the Black Lives Matter movement shed light on one of the biggest faults within the body of this former colonial power, and that is racism.
Israeli violation of the rights of Palestinians does not seem to abate. In the latest development, the regime fully closed Gaza's fishing zone, preventing Palestinians from sailing off the besieged enclave. Israeli authorities said the total closure was in response to rocket attacks from the Gaza Strip. They said five rockets were fired from Gaza at Israel overnight. But the decision comes as fishing is a significant source of income for many Gazans. The size of the fishing zone has varied over the years. It was set at 20 nautical miles by the Oslo Peace Accord in the 1990s before being reduced to 6 miles under the joint Israeli-Egyptian blockade in 2007. This, as the measure, is not enough for doing any fishing in the first place. But the Israeli regime has raised and lowered the limits several times in recent years in a bid to pressure the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas.
Israeli policy towards Gazans and their fishing industry has long been part of their plan to periodically crush Gazans and to keep the economy on life supports. I think we also have to look at the current situation in the framing of what's going on in Israel, that there is recently been an election, that Netanyahu is trying to put together a group of cohorts that will create a majority in the Knesset, and that he will often create military issues or heighten military tensions in order to increase his popularity and to get people to rally around him. So I think it's a combination of their longstanding policies and the current situation in the electorate in Israel.
The decision to fully shut the fishing zone to the Palestinians comes as Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has called for the military to prepare for any scenario regarding the Gaza Strip. Israeli Minister of Military Affairs Benny Gantz also echoed Netanyahu's remarks, saying Israeli forces will do whatever necessary to quote preserve calm. Israel's closure of the fishing zone limits what little the blockaded territory has for its food supplies. According to figures, there are some 4,000 fishermen registered in the Gaza Strip who are breadwinners of some 50,000 people. This, however, is something misleading as half of those registered are actually out of work. 95% of Gaza fishermen population lives under the poverty line. Many of them rely on humanitarian aid and belong to the 80% of Gaza's overall population who rely on such aid. But the closure of the fishing zone is not the only nightmare the Palestinians live with. The Israeli regime has put nearly 3 million people under a tight land, sea, and air blockade since 2007, bringing almost the entire population to starvation. The blockade targets Gaza's vital infrastructure, including water, energy, health, and other sectors, complicating the already dire humanitarian situation there. Gaza's health sector, for instance, is suffering from acute shortage in medicines and hospital supplies. Many believe this is itself a war crime in its own form and must be stopped.
So the issue of whether the behavior of the Israeli government and military comprise various war crimes is one that has been debated and exposed repeatedly, and there are now questions in front of the International Criminal Court, and I think that they will obviously come up with an opinion themselves. Personally, I find much of the behavior of the Israeli government and the military towards the 2.2 million Gazans can be characterized as various kinds of war crimes.
Meanwhile, the blockade has exacerbated further with COVID-19 ravaging the Gaza Strip. This brings to the spotlight the fact that the blockade and sufferings of the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip are going unnoticed.
Well, the Gazans have long been invisible on the world stage. Many of us have tried to highlight the exacerbations of the humanitarian catastrophe in view of the COVID-19 pandemic. But it's part of a longstanding pattern of valuing Jewish Israeli lives over the lives of Palestinians living in Gaza. And I think this is a combination of both medical apartheid and racism and Islamophobia and forces like that that shape international opinion.
What is questionable, however, is that the international community must have a role in bringing Palestinian sufferings to an end, and humanitarian efforts must gain momentum to get the blockade lifted. office includes international legal bodies like the International Criminal Court, which can play a key role in calling Israel to account over its decades-long crimes against the Palestinian people.
The deadly and highly contagious novel coronavirus has had a huge impact on billions of people's lives, weighing down on the economy, putting workers out of work around the globe, and more. After gaining an understanding of the virus, countries around the world began developing their versions of a COVID-19 vaccine.
It's called Operation Warp Speed. That means big and it means fast. A massive scientific, industrial, and logistical endeavor unlike anything our country has seen since the Manhattan Project.
The United States, under former President Donald Trump, launched a vaccine program dubbed Operation Warp Speed and invested heavily in producing, delivering, and distributing the jabs. The program proved successful, and the country produced different vaccines for the disease. But under patent-related restrictions, it prevented other nations from having access to the know-how to produce life-saving vaccines at home. With Donald Trump gone, President Joe Biden is now facing increasing pressure to issue a waiver for the restrictions. Several Democratic leaders, including Senators Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, have joined a petition with 2 million signatures demanding that the U.S. administration drop its support of a World Trade Organization agreement that bars other countries from accessing the patents. Charity organization Oxfam has called the current situation of the distribution of jabs in the world as vaccine apartheid, knowing that the world is dealing with a public health emergency and that the pandemic isn't a private profit opportunity.
The fact that the U.S. does not want to remove a patent on some of its key vaccine developments against COVID-19 is another symbol of how this empire is ruled by profits, by money, by the pursuit of wealth against everything else. It doesn't care about human life. It doesn't care about human beings and their health and prosperity. It cares about money because the United States worships money. Its God is money. And it's something that's horrible to understand because we're in the middle of overcoming a pandemic that is still very much a threat to a lot of people around the world.
The comments come ahead of shareholder meetings for the giant pharmaceutical company. According to data from Johns Hopkins University, peoples in the United States have received approximately a quarter of total vaccines administered around the globe. Other wealthier nations in the world have also received significantly higher numbers of vaccines compared to middle and low-income countries. A Washington Post report indicates the United States will have an oversupply of hundreds of millions of coronavirus vaccine doses as soon as July. The figure has raised concerns about possible hoarding in the country. Earlier this month, Amnesty International condemned richer countries for failing a, quote, rudimentary test of global solidarity by hoarding COVID vaccines, accusing them of exploiting the pandemic to undermine human rights. Also, the World Health Organization warned richer countries that their deals with big pharmaceutical companies will hurt the global COVAX program for poorer nations. The UN agency said its plan to roll out 1.3 billion doses of vaccine to low and middle income nations by the end of this year has been slow, as wealthier nations are approaching vaccine manufacturers that the COVAX program is counting on.
We can't expect these big countries like the United States, like the United Kingdom, to save us, because they haven't, and we're seeing that happen as we speak. We're seeing these first world developed countries hoard access to medicine and vaccines that can potentially save the lives of millions of people around the world. And the only way we're going to get around this is developing the means of production, developing infrastructure, doing what Iran is doing, what China is doing, what Venezuela and Cuba and Russia and others are doing, and creating pharmaceutical industries that are not dependent on Pfizer, not dependent on Moderna, not dependent on Johnson & Johnson, but are shared technologies by all people around the world.
We're in the middle of a pandemic that has spread to every country in the world. Unless all the Earth's 8 billion inhabitants are vaccinated, the novel coronavirus is expected to stay with us for much longer.
سبحان الله والحمد لله لا إله إلا الله والله أكبر لا إله إلا الله.
Let's listen to the famous reciters of the Holy Quran in the month of Allah.
سبحان الله والحمد لله لا إله إلا الله.
Brother Muhammad Reza Birya, only in IRIB English Radio.
Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. Welcome to this segment of the month of Allah. We'll be talking about some Quran reciters, the very prominent Quran reciters from Egypt and Iran. Today, we're going to talk about Brother Karim Mansouri. All Iranians probably know who this great reciter is, and many people around the world are familiar with this reciter. He is known for following the style of Sheikh Abdul Basit Muhammad Abdul Samad, and that is what has made him very famous, because his voice very much resembles the voice of Sheikh Abdul Basit. This great reciter was born in 1968 in Abadan, which is in Khuzestan province. When he was just 12 years old, he began learning Quran recitation, and within a very short period of time, he became a very good reciter. When he was in his 20s, he participated in some Quran competitions. For example, he participated in the Quran competition in Malaysia, and he was able to play second in that competition, because the competition in Malaysia is highly competitive, and it's extremely difficult to place first in that competition. And that is why only a few number of Iranian reciters have been able to win that competition and place first, such as Brother Hussein Rostami, the late martyr, Shahid Mohsen Haj Hassani Kargar, and just recently, Brother Hamid Ali Zadeh also was able to place first. Later on, he went to participate in the competition, Quran competition in Saudi Arabia, and again he placed second. And he has a very good memory after this competition. He said that he went to meet with the Supreme Leader of Iran, Ayatollah Khamenei, and along with Brother Parhizgar, who's also an hafiz, a hafiz of the whole Quran. He went to the Supreme Leader, and the Supreme Leader said to him, "Now that you are an international reciter and you can recite the Quran so well, it's time that you memorize the whole Quran." Karim Mansouri, Brother Karim Mansouri, did exactly that. And after 11 months, he was able to memorize the whole Quran and become a hafiz. Of course, Brother Karim Mansouri also placed first in the Quran competition in Iran. Karim Mansouri himself says that once he was reciting the Quran at a conference where many heads of Muslim countries were present in that conference, and he was reciting Surah Ash-Shams. In fact, the recitation that we're going to listen to right now is that recitation, Surah Ash-Shams, at that conference. And this is a very beautiful recitation by Brother Karim Mansouri. He says that when he got to the part where it says, وَاللَّيْلِ إِذَا يَغْشَاهَا, for 1 second he thought that he has to recite Surah Al-Layl. But then he quickly remembered that this is Surah Ash-Shams, and he was able to finish this surah correctly and without making a mistake. And it's interesting that Hafiz Asad, who was present at that gathering, said that He was so moved and influenced by this recitation that he said to Kerim Mansouri that whenever I die, I want you to recite the Quran at my funeral. And that is exactly what happened. When Hafiz Asad died, Kerim Mansouri went to Syria and recited the Quran in his funeral. Now with this introduction, let's go ahead and listen to Surah Al-Shams by Kerim Mansouri, which is in the Islamic Conference, which I just talked about. Let's enjoy this recitation.
والقمر إذا تلاها والنهار إذا جلاها والليل إذا يغشاها والسماء وما بناها والأرض وما طحاها ونفس وما سواها فألهمها فجورها وتقواها قد أفلح من زكاها وقد خاب من دساها قد أفلح من زكاها وقد خاب من دساها كلمت ثمود بطغواها إن بعث أشقاها فقال لهم رسول الله ناقة الله وسقيا فكذبوه فعقروها فكذبوه فعقروها فدمدم عليهم ربهم بذنبهم فسواها ولا صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful, by the sun and its brightness, and by the moon when it follows it, and by the day when it displays it, and by the night when it conceals it, and by the sky and he who constructed it, and by the earth and he who spread it, and by the soul and he who proportioned it, and inspired it with discernment of its wickedness and its righteousness. He has succeeded who purifies it, and he has failed who instills it with corruption. Thamud denied their prophet by reason of their transgression, when the most wretched of them was sent forth. And the messenger of Allah said to them, "Do not harm the she-camel of Allah or prevent her from her drink." But they denied him and hamstrung her. So their Lord brought down upon them destruction for their sin and made it equal upon all of them. And he does not fear the consequence thereof.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The bodies came one after another. So many bodies, in fact, that the ambulances and trucks carrying them into the crematorium blocked traffic. In New Delhi, India, a city where someone dies from COVID-19 every 4 minutes, every day is a battle not just for hospital beds, but for a space to say goodbye to the dead with dignity. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Guardian columnist Hannah Ellis Peterson. The piece is titled Grief and Anger as COVID Victims Overwhelm Delhi's Crematoriums. Bodies came one after another. So many bodies, in fact, that the ambulances and trucks carrying them into the crematorium blocked traffic. In New Delhi, India's capital, a city where someone dies from COVID-19 every 4 minutes, every day is a battle not just for hospital beds, but for a space to say goodbye to the dead with dignity. The official capacity at the Ghazipur crematorium in East Delhi is 38 bodies. And before the pandemic, only once in living memory had all the funeral pyres been taken in one day. Now, as a deadly second coronavirus wave sweeps the Indian capital, sometimes 150 bodies have already arrived by early morning. The staff have expanded operations into the car park, but it's not nearly enough. In India's capital, the coronavirus is showing no sign of abating. On Friday morning, 30th of April, Delhi registered another record-breaking 395 deaths and 24,235 cases. Across India, the total number of confirmed new cases of coronavirus was 386,693, another global record. Crematoriums are expanding at a rapid pace in India, attempting to increase capacity to cope with 1,000 cremations a day. It is here, among the pyres that get rebuilt every day for the Hindu and Sikh last rites, that the devastation caused by the COVID-19 in India's capital is most viscerally felt. Most lost their lives because families could not get them to a hospital bed, could not get them oxygen. Some got to hospitals only for the hospital to run out of oxygen. Sitting on the floor, wearing personal protective equipment in the sweltering Delhi heat, sobbing into his hands and wiping sweat from his brow, Rakesh Kumar, a 36-year-old, described how his family had driven to every hospital in New Delhi and in the neighboring city of Noida, when his mother, Sumitra Devi, had begun to struggle for breath as her oxygen crashed. But the 56-year-old never got a bed, and she died last Thursday morning. We tried so many hospitals, but even when her oxygen went down to 40%, we could not get her a hospital bed, said Rakesh Kumar. We kept going to hospitals where we were told there was availability of beds, but every time the hospital said they were full. If we could have got her a bed in hospital or got her oxygen in time, we could have saved her life. But she didn't even get a chance to survive. Like many laying their dead to rest, he was angry. The government has failed its citizens. Why could it not give us the health care that we need? Said Rakesh Kumar. In his 30 years helping to cremate the dead, Sunil Kumar Sharma, who is the head of Ghazipur Crematorium, said he had never imagined such scenes. So many dead, he said, it feels like if this continues, there will be no one left in Delhi. Though there is a supposed to be strict protocol on handling the dead bodies of coronavirus victims, Sunil Kumar Sharma said hospitals often send corpses over without any protective wrapping, risking exposing his staff to the virus. Some families, he said, tried to hide that their relatives had died of COVID-19. Narendra Kumar, a 26-year-old ambulance driver who picks up COVID bodies every day from homes and hospitals to bring to the crematoriums, also confirmed that most people he was seeing had died from lack of oxygen. "This is a terrible job," said Narendra Kumar. "I'm so scared of infecting my family that I don't go home anymore. At the end of the day, I just park my ambulance outside Gangaram Hospital and sleep there." Krishnan Pal, a 48-year-old who sold the popular Indian snack Pani Puri in his Delhi stall, was among those who died after repeatedly being turned away from overloaded hospitals when he was struggling to breathe. His cousin, Kali Charan Kashyap, said they had tried every hospital in New Delhi but could not get a hospital bed, so they drove him to Agra, a city in the neighboring state of Uttar Pradesh. In Agra, they were told that there were hospital beds but that hospitals had no oxygen. As they were driving to Bareilly, another city in Uttar Pradesh province, Pal died. "People are literally dying on the roads because they can't breathe," said Kashyap, though choking sobs as the family waited for Krishnan Pal's body to arrive from the morgue. "India needs oxygen, so I asked this government, where is it?" The political implications of a second coronavirus wave on Narendra Modi's government are becoming apparent. According to the Global Leader Approval Tracker, Narendra Modi has suffered an unprecedented 6 percentage point drop in his popularity in the past week, with his approval rating at its lowest ever level, though still high at 67%, and his disapproval rating going up to 28%. Many believe vaccines are the only long-term way out of India's coronavirus crisis, but New Delhi citizens were dealt a blow this week when the local government said plans to open up vaccinations to anyone aged 18 years and over from Saturday were being delayed indefinitely because of a lack of supplies of vaccines. Similar shortages are being experienced across India. Though the New Delhi State Chief Minister, Arvind Kejriwal, said authorities would make vaccines available as soon as possible, several private clinics and private hospitals in New Delhi said they were not expecting stocks for at least another month or even 2 months. So for now, New Delhi's crematoriums and graveyards will continue to bear the burden of death that shrouds the city every day. At Ghazipur Crematorium, as the sun sets and all the pyres were finally assembled, they were set alight at the same time, going up in a fiery roar of heat and pain.
Thank you. Stories from the Past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
In the name of Allah, the Most Merciful, the Most Beneficent, Salaam alaikum wa rahmatullah, my dear brothers and sisters and lovely listeners, thank you so very much for being with us on this episode of The Lantern, brought to you by IRRB English Radio. It's an honor and a pleasure, as always, to be with you guys today, where we're going to talk about, as usual, a short little story regarding a gardener, a dude who planted a rose. I loved his rose so very much. It kind of reminds me of Little Prince. With a cute little moral of the story to it. So without further ado, let's listen to the story real quick, and we're going to be right back, so stay with us.
The title of today's story is The Rose Within. A certain man planted a rose and watered it faithfully, and before it blossomed, he examined it. He saw the bud that would soon blossom, but noticed thorns upon the stem, and he thought, how can any beautiful flower come from a plant burdened with so many sharp thorns? Saddened by this thought, he neglected to water the rose, and just before it was ready to bloom, it died. So it is with many people. Within every soul there is a rose. The godlike qualities planted in us at birth grow amid the thorns of our faults. Many of us look at ourselves and see only the thorns, the defects. We despair, thinking that nothing good can possibly come from us. We neglect to water the good within us. And eventually, it dies. We never realize our potential. Some people do not see the rose within themselves. Someone else must show it to them. One of the greatest gifts a person can possess is to be able to reach past the thorns of another and find the rose within them.
The Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story, which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
As human beings, we look at ourselves and we are given the choice to either focus on our thorns, focus on our spikes, focus on the fact that if anyone touches us, we're going to prick their fingers and make them bleed and hurt them. Or we can focus on the fact that, hey, look how beautiful I am. That beauty that I get is from the limitless source of beauty itself, which is Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. My thorns are my sins, and my pros and my asset is my Allah. And life is perfect. If I look at it that way, is there anything I can't do? Is there any sort of success I won't be able to achieve in life? Is there any horizon I won't be able to soar to? Is there any peak of any mountain I won't be able to reach? No, there isn't. Because I see my beauty from its source. And Allah is the most ajmal, He's the most beautiful of them all. And once I rely on that, I will be able to take better care of myself because I know I'm worth it. I'll be able to invest in myself more because I know I deserve it. I'll be able to I'll be able to practice self-love because I know Allah loves me and He wants me to better myself. We have to understand that self-love definitely exists in Islam, but maybe it doesn't in the way that the capitalist or the secular world has described it. Self-love in Islam means love the self that Allah has gifted to you. Love yourself because your Creator loves you. And you know that He loves you because after all this time, He still hasn't given up on you. Sometimes when I fail to see the beauty in myself and I am only focusing on my thorns, I need to remind myself, I need to be reminded that God doesn't see those thorns in me at all. He doesn't focus on those thorns at all. He sees my potential, my capacity to grow and to bring beauty and wonder to those who observe me. And that's why He continues to bless me with bounties. In fact, that's why He even gives me trials and tests, because He wants me to grow. He wants me to transcend my limits. He wants me to move beyond the restrictions I've created in my own mind and to prove to me that I'm more than that. I'm more than my thorns. I'm more than my limitations. I'm more than the things I think I cannot do. And that is so beautiful. Romantic, even, once we really think about it, that Allah really wants what's best for me, and He will help me achieve it no matter what. It's not even tough love, it's unconditional love. It's love in its best form, in its glory, in its majesty. And all I need to do is have raja in that, have hope in that. And by having hope, it means feeling in my guts, in my heart of heart, that at the end of the day, even if all else fails, I still have Allah. He is my rock. He is who I'm going to turn to when all the strength that I have within me has failed me, and every solution I crafted in my mind turned, every solution I crafted in my mind backfired on me, and every other material means I thought I could rely on turned away from me. I still have Allah to return to. He's my first, He's my second, He's my last. Huwa al-awwal wal-akhir, as He says Himself in the Quran. He's the first and He's the last. He's my start, He's my origin, and He's my destination. In short, my absolute interpretation of Allah, He's my home. So with that in mind, I hope that we can remind ourselves that we are better than the limits that we create in our head and by the thorns that we feel keep people away from us. And if we really think about it, even those thorns could be good because they could set boundaries. They could keep people away from us in the sense of protecting us, for the objective of protecting us. And at the end of the day, everything is a bounty from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. The tests, the trials, the petals, the thorns. And we just got to think about it and put it into new perspective to figure it out. Thank you so very much for being with me on this episode of The Lantern. I leave you in the care and protection of the Almighty. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.